Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, best-selling author of the book, The Fitness Mindset, Rewire Your Mindset, and The Keen Edge, Mastering the Mindset for Real Lasting Fat Loss, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest is with Dr. Susan Pierce Thompson on why food addiction is harder than any drug, understanding eating psychology, and finally silencing your brain's inner critic. Susan is a two-time New York Times best-selling author and brain and cognitive scientist that specializes in the psychology of eating. And in today's podcast, we unpack a lot of nutritional misinformation, how your brain works on food, and a topic that I haven't previously covered, and I'm so glad we got to discuss in today's episode. I learned loads. I'm definitely going to be going back over this one with a notepad and pen myself. We started off talking about her incredible backstory. I'll let her tell it in the introduction just because I can't do it any justice. But then we dive out into the realm of food addiction, how it varies and how it feels similar to crack cocaine, her experience with that, and why accepting the label of food addict can be the first step towards recovery, how sugar and flour feel like drugs to your brain, setting up food boundaries and surrendering to a plan, substance addiction versus process addiction, and why eating is so much harder because it's also a behavior on top of a substance, silencing your own inner critic, amongst other things. So we go quite wide in this podcast episode. So as I said, it's one I'm going to be going back over with a notepad and pen. So I suggest you potentially do the same if you want to get loads from today's episode. So without further ado, here is Dr. Susan Pierce Thompson on why food addiction is harder than any drug, understanding eating psychology, and finally silencing your brain's inner critic. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I am delighted to be joined today with my guest, Dr. Susan Pierce Thompson. Dr. Susan is a two-time New York Times bestselling author and brain and cognitive scientist specializing in the psychology of eating. Her new book, Resume, The Powerful Reframe to End the Crash and Burn Cycle of Food Addiction, talks about her radical and science-verified approach to weight loss and eating that has seen widespread sustainable success and twice been covered in the Journal of Nutrition and Weight Loss. Susan is also the founder of and CEO of Bright Line Eating. The Bright Line Eating program approaches overeating as an addiction and draws a bright line around problem substances like flour and sugar. I'm looking forward to talking all things food addiction, nutrition, and the psychology of eating in general in today's episode. Dr. Susan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Brian. It's so great to be here.
Susan, I was going to talk about your backstory in the introduction, but I think it needs to come from you before we transition out and talk about your book and talk about food addiction and all the things that will potentially help people today. But talk to us about your backstory, particularly from the age of 14 on to 20, where you kind of took a different direction in your life. Talk to us a little bit about that backstory and then we can transition out.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's no sugar-coated way to put it, really. I got just really addicted to drugs. I started doing drugs when I was 14. And the kinds of drugs escalated from mushrooms and acid to crystal meth to cocaine to crack cocaine. And I dropped out of high school, never finished high school. I actually went to three different high schools and then dropped out. So my teenage years were pretty tumultuous. I became a prostitute and did that for a while before finally getting clean and sober when I was 20. So a few days after my 20th birthday, I got taken to a meeting where people are sober from drugs and alcohol, and I got struck clean. So I haven't had a drink or a drug in 27 years. And what happened then, Brian, was my addiction just hopscotched right over to food. And I started eating addictively and gaining weight very fast. And within a year, I knew that I was really addicted to food. And because I'd just been addicted to crack cocaine, I could feel the addiction in my brain. I could feel it. And I could see the signs of it. It was very clearly that I was using food, not just eating. So that, I think, it sort of put me on the fast track to understanding that eating can be truly physiologically addictive for some people, because I could tell that it was for me.
I'm very curious, as somebody that has addictive tendencies, but I won't say a full-on addict. What were the kind of similarities between, if any, it sounds like from what you're saying there, the food addiction versus the crack cocaine, because you were able to even draw that connection. What were the similarities in terms of feeling? Did you have a kind of an overlap in terms of, oh, I'm feeling myself going down this rabbit hole again, or what did that look like?
Yeah, well, there was this one night in particular that stands out where I had gone to the grocery store and bought all kinds of foods, binge foods. And, you know, I bought a box of pasta and some sort of creamy garlicky sauce. And I bought, you know, a bunch of English muffins to put butter and strawberry jam on. And I bought the ingredients for cookie dough. So I made a bunch of cookie dough and ate it raw. I bought a couple of candy bars. I bought a couple of pints of ice cream. I bought some potato chips. So I was in my room eating late into the night. I'd also bought a pack of cigarettes, and then I was going outside, smoking a cigarette, coming back in, eating more. And I was doing that all night long. So it was like 4 a.m. and I came back in from a smoke and I was looking at all this food around my room. And it really reminded me of smoking crack. It was using all night long. And that's when it dawned on me, you know, this is not sober behavior. I'm not really clean and sober here. I am using food like a drug.
That's so interesting. And one of the things I've heard you talk about is that food addiction is real and harder to beat than any drug, but recovery is possible and within our grasp. With food addiction, is it, from your experience of working with people, is it quite a wide spectrum, or do most people kind of fall into one area that they're addicted, very similar to kind of the crack cocaine? Or is it a spectrum from your experience that some people are considerably worse and turn to food more so than others? Others become a full-blown addict? Or what's been your experience with that?
Yeah, there's a huge spectrum, actually. And in fact, in our population in general, some people are just not susceptible to food addiction at all. And other people, I think you call it, what did you call yourself? Someone with addictive tendencies or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So then there's people who are in the mid-range in terms of their susceptibility. And then there's people who really, really turn to food addictively. And so there's a complete continuum. I actually talk about the food addiction susceptibility scale from 1 to 10. I'm a 10. Yay. And so someone who's like a 6, for example, probably experiences enough addiction with food that it's going to keep them from successfully losing weight and keeping it off, right? But they may not anywhere come close to relating to the type of hard addictive eating that I've experienced in my life. They might say, well, I've never done anything remotely like that, you know, gone to the grocery store, bought binge food, stayed up all night binging my brains out. You know, but they might experience the feeling of like losing control over how much they eat, you know, intending to eat one piece of pizza and then they've eaten way more than that. And, you know, addiction is in play. It's just not as severe. So there's a huge continuum.
That's brilliant. I'm really curious as well, just to follow up on that, because this is obviously your area of expertise as a cognitive scientist, but you mentioned 6 there. I would have said prior to this conversation, I'd fall on the 6 of food addiction. If I don't have systems in place, I can have really bad binge restrict cycles. Not so much now, because I've done a lot of kind of food healing relationship work over the last few years. But with it, I'm curious from your perspective, because I can only speak anecdotally from firsthand experience, can we change that level on the spectrum? Let's say we fall on a 5 or a 6, or is it something that we just have to learn to manage?
Ah, well, we do need to learn to manage it. And what happens when we get recovery, when we get better tools, better systems, better habits, better support, when we maybe start to abstain from some of the foods that, like sugar, for example, that are probably problematic for us, what happens is we can start to behave and feel like we're way lower on the scale. But what's true about the brain, about neuroscience, about the brain, is that the fiber tracks, the neural networks for extremely challenging eating, they're still there. It's one of the frustrating things, or maybe it's a good thing. I mean, I think there's benefit to it as well about the brain, is that it never ever forgets. So if you learned French in the first 3 years of your life and then moved from France to, you know, England and never really encountered French again until adulthood, that French is still there, lying dormant in your brain. And that'll be visible if you try to learn French again. You'll pick it up way faster than someone who didn't learn French in the first 3 years of life. So what happens is, as you change, as you get better habits, better skills, better coping, better support, you can experience relief. It's basically like remission from the food addiction. But what happens is you have to always be more vigilant than someone who had never had that problem at all, because your brain remembers how to get off track in that way. And you're always vulnerable to it. It's sort of the saying, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And that's true with food addiction as well. Once a food addict, always a food addict. And it just means that you have to be more vigilant not to let yourself fall back into old patterns.
That's fascinating, because I feel like you've described exactly how my brain is and how my life is, that you feel like you have it managed, but you're also very aware that you could slip back if you kind of pulled at that thread too much, to kind of keep that analogy. Yeah. From food addiction, Susan, before we dive into Resume, your new book, how would you define food addiction? Just because I know we've touched on the spectrum there, but for people listening who are like, because this is something that's very easy for people to self-diagnose themselves with, where they say, well, I'm addicted to food, as opposed to, well, are you addicted to all food? Or are you addicted to numbing out with food? Are you addicted to sugar? Are you addicted to salt? How would you define food addiction?
Yeah, great question. First of all, let's address the question of all food, right? And then I'll try to put together a definition for you. Food addiction is unique in the world of addiction in that it is both a substance addiction and a process addiction or a behavioral addiction. So the substance addiction comes in with refined processed foods, sugar, flour, chips, chocolate, that sort of thing. That's the substance. And yes, we can be addicted to that substance. And yes, abstaining from that substance might definitely want to be a part of, you know, a recovery journey for someone who feels that addiction is in play for them. But on the other hand, eating itself is a behavior like gambling, like internet gaming, that is rewarding and rich and cue laden enough that it by itself is addictive, the eating piece. And so this is where just quantities of food and any food can also feed into the addiction, which makes it really tricky to recover. This is one of the reasons why I think that food is the hardest addiction to beat. So just abstaining from specific foods may not be enough. You might also need boundaries around your eating in terms of eating only at mealtimes, eating specific quantities of food, even though it's probably going to be a lot of food that you need to eat to make sure that you're not restricting. Still having boundaries around it can be important so that your brain quiets down in terms of the, can I eat more? Did I eat enough? How about now? That piece from that, we call it food chatter, can be really important. So that's the, are you addicted to all foods or just some food? That's the sort of answer there. And in terms of a definition, you know, there are many dimensions to addiction. I sort of think of it as, and this is just loose, I don't have a pat dictionary definition for you, but I think of it as, you know, eating food in a way that feels harmful, it feels out of control, it feels like not in your best interest, and thinking about it too much as well, like dedicating more of your mental real estate to the whole problem of what you've eaten or not eaten, whether you're on your plan or off your plan, how many miles, how many calories, how many pounds, all the rigmarole that goes along with the food, weight, exercise problem. If that's taking up a bigger slice of your life than feels reasonable, that's a sign of the addiction as well.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. I've had a lot of people on the podcast who have either been in the area of disordered eating, such as, you know, competitive bikini athletes or bodybuilders or men's physique athletes, all the way to people with full-blown eating disorders. And they have all commented on the amount of mental real estate that food takes up in their brain and in their mind, that they're always thinking about it. And it's really interesting that, and for anybody listening, the amount of time that you're actually spending thinking about food probably gives you a nice indicator on how or how far you might fall along that food addiction spectrum and kind of pulling yourself back from it. From your experience, and I'm aware this is a complete Pandora's box and a how long is a piece of string question, but from your experience, Susan, with food addiction, the recovery timeline for people, do you find that it's something that it obviously varies greatly person to person, but is this something that takes, you know, months to fix, weeks to fix, years to fix? What's been kind of the average you see when somebody comes, and it obviously depends on the extent of their food addiction, their starting point, but what's the kind of general, just for people that are listening who are thinking, well, I actually have an issue with food addiction on some form of the spectrum, how much of a runway of time do I need to give myself? You know, similar if somebody says I have 20 pounds to lose, you know, do I need 6 weeks or 12 weeks or 24 weeks? What's the most realistic? What would you, from your experience, as I said, Pandora's box of a question, so I apologize in advance, but what has been your experience on average? Is this something that's more in the weeks, the months, the years when it comes to addressing and potentially fixing the issue, or fixing is a poor choice of words, managing the issue?
Yes. Yeah, I'm glad you shifted the language from fixing to managing. I think that I don't know that that's quite right either. So, you know, recovery is a process. Recovery is a process. And what's really interesting, Brian, is that it depends so greatly on how willing and ready someone is to recover. You know, I see people snap into a new mode of being with their food almost instantly upon adopting Bright Line Eating in some cases, where the minute they start putting their food on the digital food scale, surrendering sugar and flour, following the plan, connecting with the community, they report feeling almost like they've stepped into a new universe. Like it just feels like every bit of life feels different for them. And not that there aren't some speed bumps in the road, not that it's, you know, not hard sometimes to get through certain events or parties or whatever, but once they start their recovery journey, they feel better significantly. Their life is never the same again, and they lose their weight relatively rapidly. They transition to maintenance, and they just never look back. So I see that. That happens. I wouldn't say that's the rule. I would say that that's maybe the case for 10, 15, 20% of people, something like that. And then on the other end, you've got people who, I'll just be frank, struggle for years and years and years, on and off, on and off, on and off, on and off. And, you know, and then there's folks for whom, you know, it's a bit more of a grind, but I can say that we have data from people starting our Bright Line Eating program showing that on average, well, first of all, within a couple months, half the people are gone. Like just not, you know, it's rigorous and it's not for everybody. And you have to really want it, you know, you have to really want it. So within 2 months, half the people are gone. But of the people who stay, within 2 months, their hunger has gone down. Their peace and serenity with food has gone dramatically up. And their cravings have faded away to little to nothing within 2 months. So we do see significant brain healing within 2 months.
That's brilliant to know and so interesting. I think the brain science around it is absolutely fascinating as somebody that comes at things from a scientific standpoint, but it's nutritionist and nutrition kind of 101 that I've always specialized in, not the brain side. So I think it's fascinating. You mentioned there, Susan, how willing someone is to recover. What would be some of the common barriers that would stop somebody being willing to recover? Because again, as somebody that has worked with so many people myself, and the same with you, and the amount of people coming through the Bright Line program, have read your books, etc., we know that there's going to be things, some people are just going to be in a position to make the change. But from your experience, what would be some of the common barriers that could potentially stop somebody if they've decided, you know, I want to recover? Or is it a case that it's something they think they want, as opposed to they haven't made a commitment to themselves, or they haven't made the decision themselves to fully invest in this in terms of emotionally and, you know, figuratively, mentally, everything that needs to be invested in order to make a change in your life? What are some of the common barriers you see to that?
I think one of the common barriers is really not accepting the label, if you will, of food addict, like just resisting that addiction is really what's happening. And I'm not really that excited about labeling people either. I think that, you know, there's a good reason why the mental health field has moved away from labels like food addict and alcoholic and moved toward person with food addiction or person, like human being with alcoholism. On the other hand, I think that there's something very empowering in owning a condition or a disease that you actually have, because it makes you willing to treat it, right? If you resist the notion that, you know, your brain probably forever is wired to be addictive around food, you know, it gives you a lot of motivation to seek recovery and to do whatever it takes to at least put that condition in remission. So that's one piece of resistance that I see people have, is they're like, well, I don't know that this really applies to me. I don't know that really food addiction is, you know, is the thing. I mean, certainly I overeat, you know, certainly I lose control over my eating sometimes. Certainly I've struggled with this weight thing for a long time. But I think for some people, it can take time, and some people never kind of get to a place where they embrace the notion that food addiction is in play. So that's one. And then what happens is they typically aren't willing to work a program that's strong enough to address the actual addiction that they do have in play, right? Like, it's no skin off my back. I don't care if they call themselves a food addict or not. But what happens is then they just end up making exceptions and, you know, resisting parts of the recovery prescription that really they need in order to get free, right? So that's one thing. Let me think, what's another key barrier? I think people get tripped up in the nutritional minutiae, holding on to old ideas that they've had over how to eat or not eat, or, you know, like in Brightline Eating, the basic weight loss food plan has two fruits a day, one at breakfast, one at lunch, right? Among other things, obviously. But like, you know, if you're like, oh, I can't eat fruit, that's too many carbohydrates, you know, or whatever, you know, and it's just sort of like, people do better when they just surrender to the plan. It's a very balanced plan, nutritionally, extremely healthy. And if people kind of hang on to, oh, but I've got a, I don't know what, you know, people are all into their whatever, their particular macros that they're fond of or their whatever, that can be a challenge too. Some people just don't surrender fully. Like, you know, in the Brightline Eating program, there's no sugar and no artificial sweeteners, right? And some people will just, you know, kind of ignore that, keep drinking diet soda or whatever. Well, you know, the taste buds on the tongue the sweet taste buds on the tongue have direct connections to the addiction centers in the brain. So they're not letting their brain heal, you know? So those are some basic things.
Yeah, I think that surrendering to the plan for sure can work great for some people. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you're going to have people who will need to make the adoptions. But if you're coming at this, anyone that's listening, where you have an issue with food and food addiction, surrendering to the plan and giving it the runway of time, like you said, giving it 2 months, see how you feel, see how your body feels, see how your brain is, see how your head is, see how your mood is, all of these things. And then you at least can course correct and, you know, potentially reintroduce foods or stay off it if you feel great. You have all these options once you've given it a good runway of time. I think that a big misconception people have, or not even misconception isn't the right word, an issue that people can have is that they don't surrender to the plan. They take bits and pieces from certain plans, which can completely lead to random results. You know, if you randomly take a plan, randomly change it up yourself, you're going to get random results with it. So I think it's important, and just to double down on your message there, Susan, if you are going through this plan or going through any other plan, it's very important that you make sure that you're doing what's meant in it, or else you're not going to potentially get the results. But you gave me a nice little segue there, because I do want to double back on the not accepting the label of food addiction. And I did want to ask you about thinking about food as an addiction and how it helps to change negative patterns. What have you seen with that? Again, the empowerment, the ownership, I love that. I think, as you said, if attaching to the label gives you the potential empowerment to go and make a change, that's a great thing. But what are some of the negative patterns that thinking about food as an addiction can potentially help people change with in terms of what you've seen?
Oh, when people finally accept food addiction as really being true for them, I see it all get easier. It just all gets easier because then they accept the solution into their life. You know, they accept the prescription. It's like they start taking their medicine, you know, for this issue that they've got. And it's just so much easier to work the program 100% and not fight it. It gets actually really easy, frankly. So yeah, I just see a lot of ease come into their life, just a lot of ease.
With the Brightline Eating Program, and you've mentioned it there a couple of times about removing things like sugar and flour, kind of problem substances, from a kind of cognitive neuroscience aspect, why is it so important to potentially remove these foods?
Yeah, great question. Well, it all comes down to what acts in the brain as a drug. And so as a drug addict myself in recovery, I've thought pretty deeply about what makes something a drug. So let's start with obvious drugs, heroin and cocaine. Cocaine, what is cocaine? Like, where does it come from? Do you know where cocaine comes from, Brian?
Is it the cacao leaf?
Yeah, not cacao, but coca.
Coca leaf.
So it's different from cacao, but coca, the coca leaf. And so there are these bushes in the Andes Mountains, the coca bush, and they have these leaves. People, hikers in the Andes Mountains, will pluck these leaves and put them in their cheek and chew them or just hold them in their cheek there. And it makes their cheek numb and it gives them a slight lift, maybe like the equivalent of drinking, I don't know, half a cup of caffeinated tea or something like that. Very mild. There actually is a published scientific paper showing that chewing coca leaves is not addictive. But if you take the inner essence of that coca leaf and then you refine and purify it down into a fine white powder, you've now turned this harmless plant into a drug. And it's the same with heroin. Where does heroin come from? Pop quiz.
Heroin poppy plant?
Yes, heroin comes from poppy plants.
That's all the Netflix narcos. My drug knowledge is whatever is limited to that show is where my drug knowledge comes from.
Totally. So you can eat poppy seed bagels. You can eat poppy seeds in food and you will actually fail a drug test. You will test positive for opium, but you won't get addicted and you won't become an addict because it's not addictive. But if you take the inner essence of that poppy plant and then you refine and purify it down into a fine brown powder or into a sludgy liquid, which is sort of like making high fructose corn syrup, actually, which is what heroin is the sludgy brown liquid, you will have turned that harmless plant into a drug. So this is how sugar and flour are made. Sugar comes from any number of substances. It can come from brown rice. It can come from white rice. It can come from sugar cane plants. It can come from beets. It can come from corn, all sorts of things. But all those plants are harmless in and of themselves in their whole real form. But if you take the inner essence and then you extract it and then you refine and purify it down into a fine powder or down into a sludgy liquid, you've now turned a harmless, healthy plant into a drug. And this is why flour is a problem too. You take the inner essence of, you can make flour out of just about anything. Take the inner essence of, you know, any grain or legume and you extract or nut or whatever, you extract it, you refine it and purify it down into a powder. Now you've created a drug out of a harmless plant. And so these drugs, they hit the brain differently, particularly the nucleus accumbens in the reward addiction pathway of the brain. They flood the nucleus accumbens with dopamine, excess dopamine. And then that part of the brain responds back by downregulating those dopamine receptors, which means it makes them less numerous, less responsive. And now you've altered your brain and you've become addicted. That's essentially the hallmark of addiction in the brain is downregulated dopamine receptors in the nucleus accumbens. And whole real plants don't cause that, but extracted, purified, refined drug foods do. Sugar and flour do. That's what they cause.
Is there any other foods that rank high on that list of not necessarily to completely avoid, but definitely be mindful of? Obviously, flour, sugar, a no-go on the Brightline Eating, but what are the ones jump to mind?
Yeah, chocolate, cacao. I just say, you know, chocolate always ranks in the top three most addictive foods. And so I tell people to avoid cacao altogether. I know it's a health food, it's a superfood, blah, blah. It's also addictive. And unfortunately, even though I know that cacao powder is very bitter, and, you know, if that's all we were ever exposed to in our lives, we probably wouldn't have associated it with anything addictive. But most of us have developed quite an addictive association with cacao, so with chocolate. So I encourage people to avoid that. And then also chips. So some chips, like corn chips, are made out of flour, corn flour, and some are made out of potato chips are made out of the you know, and I don't know, I'm not talking about French fries. I'm talking about, I don't know, what do you call?
Yeah,
you call
crisps, potato chips. Yeah.
Crisps. Okay. So some of them are made out of the inside of a white potato, and then they're deep fried. And that inside of that white potato is molecularly equivalent to flour. It's just glucose molecules with no fiber that's helping to mitigate that at all. So those in popcorn, those would be some of the other. So popcorn, potato chips, they sort of masquerade as flour. They're basically, you know, carbohydrate sources with no helpful fiber, and whatever is being done to process them, it makes them addictive. So yes, those are the additional ones.
Brilliant. I want to take a step in a slightly different direction now, because on the Instagram page, there was something that was really useful. And when I think of underrated weight loss tools, I think step counts, neat activity, non-exercise activity, thermogenesis. And you had a post up about losing weight without exercise, which I think is something that's very misunderstood. That exercise, yes, it has great benefits potentially for, you know, bone strength and resistance and, you know, metabolic rate. You'll burn more calories while you're resting. You'll feel good, your mood. But for losing weight, you don't necessarily need it. You just need to obviously dial in your nutrition and potentially move more throughout the day. So I think it's a huge underrated weight loss tool. But from your perspective, Susan, what's a massively underrated weight loss tool that more people should know about?
Writing down your food the night before. So there's research studies showing that people lose way more weight when they write down their food at all, like after they've eaten, right? If you write down your food before you've eaten, you plan it out. And ideally have a food plan, like a structure, a template that you follow, like, you know, how many servings of vegetables are you eating in a day? That kind of thing. The Brightline Eating Plan gives you that. It's really simple. But, you know, if you're not going to do Brightline Eating, just at least have an idea of what your food plan template is, meaning what times of day do you eat and what kind of food categories are you putting in there? And write down your food the night before and then commit it. Like, you're committing to that. And the next day, your job is to eat only and exactly that. Every other bite of food is a no thank you.
That's really, it sets up, it's kind of the systems over willpower thinking. You know exactly what you're going to eat the following day. You're following the plan and you're keeping that commitment and promise to yourself. So not only will it help your weight loss goal, I think, you know, you build confidence in your eating plan by consistently keeping promises to yourself. So saying I'm going to eat this and then doing it the next day is a great tool to do that. Talk about Rezum, Susan. We've been jumping around on a lot of different topics today, but a lot of this is covered in Rezum and in your first book as well, you know, Brightline Eating. Talk about Rezum, because this is, you've gone in a slightly different direction with this from your first book, and the feedback and some of the reviews I've been reading from people has been incredible so far. So it's having a massive impact already. But what was the reason for writing Rezum?
Well, Brian, after years and years and years of no sugar, no flour, weighing and measuring my food, after I started the Brightline Eating movement, I started traveling a whole lot. Brightline Eating exploded. It just took off around the world. And I started traveling a whole bunch to conferences and speaking engagements. And I have three little children. And what happened was I started breaking my bright lines. Like, my life just got too big, too chaotic, too stressful. And for a few years there, like 4 years, I was on and off breaking my bright lines. I didn't gain back significant weight because I would get right back on track really fast. And my identity as the leader of the Brightline Eating movement is very strong. So I had a force that was keeping me bright most of the time, but the food addiction was reawakened, if you will, like we were talking about at the beginning of this conversation, that those fiber tracks are always laying in wait for you. And my food addiction was reawakened. And in that pressurized pressure cooker of My food addiction being awake and alive, and the stress and restaurants and eating chaos, like eating off plan sometimes, and then coming and then having to get back on track because I couldn't gain weight. You know, I could not gain weight. And thank God I did not go back to bulimia, but I, you know, really, really got probably 40 years worth of experience breaking and resuming in 4 years. And at some point during that madness, it was very painful, very painful. And I was very honest about it with my community. I did not try to pretend that my bright lines were perfect. I told people that I was struggling again. And there were times when I binged, and I would put a vlog out about it. And I would say, last night I binged, and here's what happened. Here's what I'm learning from it. It introduced a lot of compassion into our Bright Line Eating program, because when you try to follow a food plan like this, I think perfectionism really gets in the mix. And let's be frank, with addiction in play, sometimes aiming for perfect is the right goal, right? Like if you want to quit smoking, you really are aiming for never smoking a cigarette perfectly. That is your goal, right? You want to quit smoking. You want to be someone who never again has a puff of a cigarette as long as you live. That is the goal. But beating yourself up about it if you fall back doesn't help. That creates a shame spiral, right? And then you just want to hide and eat more or smoke more, right? So the book Resume was created basically from all of that experience. And over the years, I learned how to up-level my support and how to work my program differently so that I wouldn't break my bright lines anymore. So now it's been, I don't know, two and a half years since I've had a break in my bright lines, just back on the wagon again, clean, peaceful, easy. Just my food is fine. It's just in its place. I don't think about it much, you know, and I'm working out regularly. Just all of that is kind of in its place. And the book Resume really captures the essence of the lessons I learned during that time.
I love that. With the shame spiral, I'm very curious, what's your process? I know you haven't broken it in a couple of years now, but you unpack, you know, Resume. The language I use with my clients has always been, you know, reset. You fall off track, you reset, and you get back on track again. Resume is very similar methodology to, right, you're back on the bright line. With that shame spiral, what's your process for avoiding that? You've mentioned there that it's not beneficial to obviously fall on that shame spiral, and I couldn't agree more, and you know this better than anybody based on the amount of people you've worked with and your own personal anecdotal experience. How do you avoid that shame spiral? Because there's people listening who are potentially following Bright Line or following another nutritional strategy or just trying to stick to a food plan in general, and then they fall off track and then they spiral into this shame spiral, as you said. What was your process for either avoiding that or not letting it take control so that spiral doesn't become out of control by just going deeper and deeper into it?
Yeah, totally. Well, the crux of it is that you've got to develop self-compassion, which means talking kindly to yourself, especially when you blow it. Like you would talk to a best friend, right? Like you would talk to someone you just adore and cherish, a really beloved person in your life. And but the problem is, you know, we all kind of know that we should talk kindly to ourselves. And when we don't, it just gives us another reason to beat ourselves up, right? That inner critic can be so harsh. So in the book Resume, I introduce a framework called parts work, which is based on internal family systems. It's a form of therapy that is all the rage right now in psychology. And I introduce it in the book Resume, and we go deep into the various parts of our psyche. And one of those parts is the inner critic, the part that just criticizes ourselves, that shames us, that judges us, that berates us sometimes. And people vary in the strength and sort of nastiness of their inner critic. But it's important to recognize that the inner critic is actually trying to help us, funny enough. It has a terrible approach to it. And it, you know, the net impact of the inner critic is definitely damaging on the psyche, but it's trying to help. And what it's trying to do is it's trying to protect us from what it fears will happen if we don't shape up, if we're not perfect, if we don't, like, it knows how important our goals are to us. And it also is typically very afraid of judgment from others. So it's trying to help us be loved by and accepted by helping us be perfect or good enough, right? And so when you conceive of that inner critic as not all of us, but a part of us, and you start to get curious and calm about what its motive is and why it is, you know, why it's talking to us that way, you can do helpful things. Like, you can shrink it down. You can take that inner critic. If you can picture it, sometimes it's helpful to even picture it as a person. You know, what would that inner critic voice look like if it were a person? Would it be a stern librarian with a tight bun and, you know, glasses? Would it be a mean judge? Would it be a kid on the schoolyard bullying us? What would that inner critic look like? And then we can make it smaller. We can shrink it down. We can even put it in a jar and then, like, put it on the windowsill. And there are ways to work with these parts inside of us. And we get into this in the book Resume. There's other parts of us, the food indulger part, the food controller part, the isolator part, the caretaker part. So we all have, and I'm talking about, by the way, Brian, a healthy human psyche. I'm not talking about multiple personality disorder here or dissociative identity disorder. I'm talking about healthy people all have parts inside of them. We're not really a unified mind. Socrates said it best. He said, one mind cannot both want and not want at the same time. Therefore, we must all be at least two. So, you know, every time we want to eat a piece of cake and we don't want to eat a piece of cake at the same time, those are two different parts. There's a food indulger part and a food controller part in the mix there. So we're all always operating from these multiple parts of ourselves. And so really the deepest, you know, the shame spiral comes from somewhere real, Brian. It's not, you know, it's not like, oh, be nicer to yourself or, oh, don't, you know, whatever. It's like, there is no Band-Aid solution for that. It really requires deep inner work. But luckily, it doesn't have to take a long time. Once you learn the tools, you can learn how to get out of it pretty quickly.
And I think that's the reason the book is having such impact with people, because you've broken down those parts, as you said, the rebel part, the inner critic part, the isolator part. It allows people to visualize that and see it. The language I've used on the podcast in the past is the angel and devil on your shoulder. Like, you know, I do a lot of ultra endurance events, and when I'm running, say, a 100-mile race or whatever it is, I picture like a green goblin on my shoulder who's like, stop, 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 stop. And you're just silencing it. You're just keeping it quiet. Whereas somebody with an issue with food, you're going to have your own version of that green goblin, or your own version of an angel and a demon telling you to, you know, eat or not to eat, or whatever your picture is, or whatever your wording is for that. And I think the awareness that the book brings to that helps people see that there's actually nothing wrong with that thinking. We all have versions of it, but being aware of it is the first step towards potential change. And I think you break it down so well there, so really appreciate that, Susan. I just have one final question, because you've given me a lovely little segue into it. You talked about self-compassion there, and I think that's something that I've definitely spent the last probably 5 or 6 years being better with, or trying to improve in terms of a what I would call probably a personality flaw of that type A personality, being very hard on myself, tough love, and that's my default. It can be really good and lead to some external success, but it leads to a lot of inner turmoil and anxiety. So I've been trying to work on that self-compassion, and I've been trying to, you know, advice I would have offered my younger self would be more compassionate and learn from your mistakes and don't beat yourself up. But I'm very curious, based on your history and background and all the things you've done over the last few years, the movement, the amount of people you've helped, the books, and even based on your own background and your kind of crazy upbringing in those teenage years, if you could go back to your 18-year-old self, Susan, what advice would you give her or somebody in a similar position? I know there's always the butterfly effect. You'd be afraid to change the path and you wouldn't be who you are had that not happened. But somebody in a similar position at 18, 19, particularly, I would normally ask that question a bit older, but based on you had a very different change in life trajectory from 20 onwards, if you could go back to 18, what would be the advice you'd offer yourself or someone in a similar position?
Well, I wouldn't say anything to my own 18-year-old self. Maybe it is the butterfly effect there, being concerned. Like, I wouldn't want to change anything that's transpired. But also, I think I was doing fine. Like, I needed to do what I needed to do, you know? So I might say something like, you keep going, sweetie. This is all going to work out. Something like that. For someone else who was in my position, I would say, get yourself to a 12-step program. Sweetheart, you're using a lot of drugs. Get yourself to a 12-step program. Because if I hadn't had that, that's really what turned things around for me in terms of the drugs, was working the 12 steps and being in a very compassionate, loving community of people committed to recovery. So my life really started there. Yeah, that's the advice that I would have for someone who is in similar shape at age 18.
And would you say, just to piggyback on that, as a genuine final question, if someone with food addiction, would you offer something similar, find a program, find a group, find a community, or would it be something different if it was specifically to somebody with food addiction?
Yeah, I really am a believer in not doing it alone. It, you know, because it doesn't work usually, right? It just doesn't work. This kind of transformation, it happens in community. So whether it's Bright Line Eating or a 12-step food addiction program, you know, I'm of course partial to Bright Line Eating, but I'm super biased, right? So yeah, I absolutely get support, for sure, get support.
Amazing, and such a great way to finish. And Susan, I can't thank you enough for the work that you do, for your time, the amount of value that you've shared in today's podcast. For people listening, where is the best place for them to reach out, connect with you? Where can they pick up the books? And for anyone that wants to check out the Bright Line Eating Program, any links you want to give now, please do that.
Yeah, absolutely. So Bright Line Eating, you can start and give those first two months a try at brightlineeating.com. BRIGHTLINE. brightlineeating.com. And you can find me there too. Yeah, just get into our community, sign up, and I'm right there in our community. And the books are available anywhere, as far as I know. I mean, you're in Ireland, right? So, but I'm pretty sure, what do you have, Amazon UK or whatever?
Amazon UK or the Book Depository tend to be the kind of the two big ones here.
Yeah, sure. It should be available anywhere. Resume and Bright Line Eating should both be available. Yep.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, I will link up everything we've talked about in today's podcast. The website link, the books links will be in the description wherever you are listening to podcasts, and they'll be available on the show notes on BrianKeenFitness.com. Susan, thank you so much again for your time. Keep doing what you're doing, and I look forward to catching up soon.
Thank you so much, Brian. It's been great.
There you have it. Dr. Susan Pierce-Thompson on why food addiction is harder than any drug, understanding eating psychology, and finally silencing your brain's inner critic. I am definitely going back over this one with a notepad and pen. So much in here, particularly the cognitive neuroscience and how the brain works with certain foods. Really looking forward to writing up this week's email. For those of you who are already subscribed, you'll get it on Thursday. So every Thursday, I send out my email newsletter with my top three takeaways from that week's podcast episode. So I'm really going to enjoy doing this one with all the things to think about off the back of the podcast. As always, if you enjoyed, be sure to, if you want to hear that, obviously head over to BrianKeenFitness.com and just pop your email into the newsletter and you'll be subscribed and you'll get it every Thursday. And as always, if you enjoyed today's episode, pop it up on your Instagram. You can tag me or myself on my page, Brian_Keen_fitness, and you can tag Dr. Susan on the Instagram page on Bright Line Eating. I will link that in the description in the show notes as well. That's all for me for this week. Catch you all next Monday.